Hello, this is Joe McGee. You know, we've been doing seminars across the country for years. Seminars on marriage, parenting, men, money, and family. We want to encourage you to email us and let us know if this podcast has helped you. Or maybe you have joined us live at one of our seminars. If you have a testimony, you just want to tell us what God's doing in your life, please email us at mail@joemcgeeministries.com, or you can contact us through our website, joemcgeeministries.com. There you will find helpful articles and tools to help you grow in God, your marriage, and your family. We love you guys. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Hey, everybody, it's Joe McGee. Hey, we're going to cover some interesting things today. One of the things I did when I was a school administrator, I tried to collect a lot of biographies. And believe it or not, I collected over 1,200 biographies in a 10-year run, short ones that I would share, you know, because I'm teaching, every day for 171 days every school year. So I collect a lot of biographies. And I'm trying to encourage kids to realize that most people that became very successful in life had to overcome a lot of stuff. That there's no such thing as luck. There's no bad luck. There's no good luck. There's no luck. There's God, the devil, and we're kind of in between like an Oreo cookie. So God says, I set before you life, death, blessing, cursing. You get to choose. So every day we get to make choices. So what I did was collected biographies of people who overcame incredible obstacles to become very successful at what they did. So today this is about what we call Reader's Digest. And I think every home in America probably had one. And so what you need to know that Reader's Digest publishes about 28 million copies every month. They're in 170 countries. They got 100 million readers. They're in 17 languages. A quarter of all American homes subscribe to Reader's Digest. So, you know, if you pick up a copy, it's got its mixes of reprints of original stories about health and politics and religion, positive thinking, inspiration, heroic true life dramas, humor. It gives only a small clue to the wide, diverse appeal that it has. A casual reader could imagine that how does something like this even get started? Well, it started with a Midwestern minister's son named DeWitt Wallace, believe it or not. He got kicked out of high school in 1907. Now, who's this? Well, it's a minister's son got kicked out of high school. Well, isn't that a great story? And so at age 17, so he hung around the country for a year, enrolled finally in the University of California, from which he promptly dropped out. So Wallace went to work at his uncle's bank in Colorado, where he began reading voraciously. He loved to read. So he kept a reading card file summarizing all the best articles he'd run across. After a few years, he moved back to St. Paul and got a job there working at promotional literature for a magazine called The Farmer. One day, while looking at government pamphlets, he realized that most farmers had no idea about the helpful information that existed for them. So Wallace put together a pamphlet describing available publications and set out in a car to sell it to banks in rural areas for goodwill distribution to their customers. So he sold 100,000 copies around the Midwest. One night while laying a week in a Montana bunkhouse, he began thinking about doing something similar for general readership. So in 1916, he goes back to St. Paul, worked for a mail order manager for a greeting card company. Bored with his job, he immediately enlisted in the Army when World War I broke out. Now, this guy's bounced around like a hot potato, man. He's moving around. So in France, half his battalion was killed, and Wallace was hit with shrapnel in the neck, the nose, the abdomen, and the lungs. So he spent the rest of his stint in a French hospital. Like I said, hell's popping up everywhere. While there, he filled the time by reading American magazines. The writing style at the time was more flowery than it is now, in part because writers were paid by the word. So, an experiment. Wallace began rewriting some of the articles, thinking of them in length and retaining as many of the story's original words as possible. And he came to the conclusion that most of them could be shortened by at least 75% without losing the flavor. In other words, he would just read a story and say, you know, I can cut 3/4 of this out. Most of this is just flowery words. Let's get to the point. By the time Wallace came back to the States in 1919, he had perfected the technique of condensing popular literature. You understand how things are working out? Reader's Digest doesn't exist, but the idea for it is already it's in the bank right now. January 1920, he put together a simple copy of what was called the Reader's Digest. He started that off with that name. It was remarkably similar to what the Digest is now, containing 31 shortened articles of enduring value and interest, reprinted from other publications with titles like The Art of Opening a Conversation, How to Regulate Your Weight, What People Laugh At, and America's Most Popular Crime. Man, he knew how to hang the sign out. It was really good. He had several hundred copies of the dummy printed up and sent them off to publications all over the country. All he wanted was for one of them to pick up the idea and hire him to be an editor. Instead, he got rejection letters from every one of them. If you included the reasons, the editor of the Woman's Home Journal said, said the magazine only carries articles because it was necessary to attract advertisers. So why would they be interested in a magazine in which the articles are the whole point? Only William Randolph Hearst, the millionaire newspaper guy, only he wrote back, faintly encouraging him. He said, you're at the Digest might in time hit a circulation of maybe 300,000 subscribers, but that his company wouldn't be interested in a venture that small. Wallace had spent all of his money then on the prototype, and he was discouraged. He gave up and turned his attention back to wooing a childhood friend named Lila Bell, who was working as a social worker for the YMCA. We all have potential, don't we? Wallace took a job at Pittsburgh while promoting work for Westinghouse, but he was fired shortly afterward. You ever notice you can't hold a job real good? if you were a dad looking for a potential son, you're not on my list. But anyhow, he was fired. The lady, though, married him anyway and encouraged him to publish his magazine himself. So he started soliciting potential subscribers one by one from doctors, nurses, professors, teachers. And over the next several months, Wallace invented a personalized, direct pitch mailing that the Digest was successful used for years after that. He developed a web how to market something. So he would write a letter saying, "Dear John Smith, how are things at 1313 Mecklenburg Lane?" Very personal. Wrote letters to everybody, one at a time. It's not a mass mailing list. He built a mailing list. The only problem was there were decades before this kind of thing came easy. For 4 months, Wallace himself typed the individual page of the mailing list. Every page he typed himself, describing his new publication, offering a money-back guarantee, asking for subscribers to get a subscription to it. Well, provisional subscriptions and funds began dribbling in a little bit. When the Wallaces had received $5,000 in subscriptions, they borrowed another $1,300 and published 5,000 copies of the initial Reader's Digest, February 1922, Volume 1, Number 1. It ran to 62 pages with no illustrations, no color, a cover that was set all black and white stock, no advertising. The Digest would continue a no-ads policy for 33 years. The Wallaces moved to New York, rented a small place in Greenwich Village. They got an office at a speakeasy at One Minetta Lane. When the first 5,000 copies came back from the printer, the Wallaces had some barflies upstairs and women in the community club down the street that helped wrap them and address them. So he got them on volunteer army to mail all these things out. They mailed Volume 1 out that night, excited but scared. They'd blown all the money. They're broke. They expected, that they collected for 1 year of subscriptions, but they've only published one. You're supposed to get this once a month. We spend every dime just to get the first month out. To save money, they sublet one room of their apartment to somebody else. And so they're living with somebody else living in their apartment. To their relief, nobody canceled. Oh, thank goodness for that. And more importantly, word of mouth started bringing up a steady stream of subscribers. Within 6 months, they had 7,000 subscribers to Reader's Digest. Feeling cramped by the piles of magazines, correspondents, the Wallaces rented a cottage in a small town, absurdly called the name of Pleasantville. I'm not making this up, it's true. Where Reader's Digest headquarters remains to this day. They got together and they had several years, they're publishing articles. They did marketing, included on the, started doing some advertising in their magazines. Wallace made the final selection, condensed the articles in longhand on one legal piece of paper, arranged them permanently for publication. By 1925, circulation was up to 16,000. They began hiring a small staff. By 1929, circulation reached 200,000 and climbing, reaching 1,450,000 by 1936. They began Reader's Digest books offering condensed versions of popular literature. The Wallaces continued at the top of the masthead for the next five decades. They became incredibly rich and reportedly gave away $100 million to charities, educational institutions, religious organizations, arts, and political organizations. Both died in their 90s and the early 1980s. That is the story of Reader's Digest. How'd you get this thing? Well, we just started off with an idea. What happened? Well, we got fired. We got laid off. A war broke out. I got severely injured. I'm laid in a hospital in France, in a foreign country, all for months. But I kept working. I kept reading articles. I kept reading stuff. Everybody's got a passion for something. I used to tell people, when I worked as an administrator, every child has a passion for something. Might be playing chess, tiddlywink, checkers, spitting things on the ceiling. Every child's got a passion for something. It can be converted into making money. Every child's a gift. They should teach people. Every child's got a gift. Everybody's able to do something and make money at it. We had one kid, I remember, in high school. His dad was an accountant, very successful. His grandfather was an accountant, very successful. Well, he wants to be an accountant. Problem was, he can't pass Algebra 1 hardly. And you've got to get Algebra 2 to get into college. The college entrance test was mostly all Algebra 2. I said, son, you're not going to be an engineer, and you're not going to build a bridge. If you build a bridge, put your name on it, because I'm not going to drive across it, because you stink at math. It is not your strong point. You're great with your mouth and words. You're a good speaker. You're a good organizer. So you might run your daddy's company, but you're not going to build anything in that company. You're going to have to hire engineers a lot smarter than you. But you can do that. There is a way to make it. And so many times we try to get pigeonholed. You know, my family's done it. Grandfather, my father, me, my own kids. You try to pigeonhole. But then you begin to realize something. Angel and I, we have 8 adult children. No two are even remotely the same. We laugh about it all the time. It's hard to believe they had the same parents. They are so different. Every child has a different thumbprint. They have a different voice print. They have different desires. I joke all the time. You know, we had our first baby, and I thought, good night, that first baby was like an experiment. About the time you learn to raise a one-year-old, they turn two. About the time you learn to raise a two-year-old, they turn three. You're chasing that first kid their whole life. And so finally you have a second child, and you think, okay, I know what to do. First child is a guinea pig. God bless you. I'm sorry. I was learning from you. I'm sorry I didn't win a better parent, but I was learning. And so the second child comes down, and you think, I'm ready now. Problem is, second child is nothing like the first child. Not even remotely. Think, oh, man, what is this? It's like a zoo. God is a very creative God. And so God's got a great sense of humor. All you need is God and his grace and his word, and you can do it. And so what I love about collecting all these biographies, people became millionaires and billionaires that couldn't do two other things put together. But they had a passion. They had a passion to do something, and they chased it. Nobody could have told him, hey, you know, one day you're going to own a billion-dollar company called Reader's Digest. No, I'm just trying to get a job right now. You know, I'm just doing what I like doing. And he had no clue, no dream. But Reader's Digest is history. Now, we've got hundreds and hundreds of other stories we're going to share. So stay tuned. You learn something new every time. God bless. Put your hand to something, guys. Hey, thanks for listening today. Be sure to join us Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear more of what God can do in your life. He's got a great future for you and your family, and we are here to help you get there. Make sure and go to our website, joemcgeeministries.com. We've got all sorts of materials, books, DVDs, you name it, all there to help you, your marriage, and your family succeed.